Good afternoon.
How are you doing today?
Super.
So we're going to flip the two agenda items. Is that right? Because Dave has
David
to, I believe, catch a flight. All right, good.
And if you, I don't know if you saw this, we have two new people if you want to recognize them.
Good. I will. All right, ladies and gentlemen, this is a meeting of the Joint Interim Task Force on Oregon Retirement Savings created by House Bill 3436. There's a change to our agenda today just by way of getting everybody teed up. We're going to have Dave John from AARP go first because he has a flight that he, I believe it's a flight. If I'm making that up, it's still a good excuse. He has a flight to catch. And so Mary's agreed to follow, which I appreciate. We have two new members up here today, and I want to take just a moment to introduce both of them. To my right at the far end here, we have Bert Guptill. Bert, am I pronouncing your name correct?
Just like it's spelled.
Perfect. Guptill, he's joining the task force. He was appointed by the governor, and they just made that appointment official. He has expertise in the financial sector. And if you don't mind, if I could impose on you, Bert, if you could just tell us all a little bit about yourself and why you wanted to be on this task force, or alternatively, tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got arm twisted into being here.
Can you hear me okay? Do you want the mic? Fine, okay. I moved to Oregon almost 40 years ago, unemployed. Hooked up with the Horace Mann insurance companies, working primarily with school teachers, everyday people, still doing it after 37 years. Selling intangibles is not easy. You can see the sandwich you eat, the pizza on Friday night, but the $10 to buy that pizza out of your payroll to save, that's another question. So I got my experience for those years, and I hope it can be of some benefit here. I love Oregon. Won't say more. I've testified on occasions on life insurance when the state wanted to propose a bill to tax the internal buildup on life insurance and that all-important death benefit. We won that battle in subcommittee. I also have testified in the past on STOLI, that stranger-owned life insurance, going around and buying life insurance on people. Hopefully they're going to die and you make a profit. So I've had a little bit of experience. But I actually care. My career has been based on working with everyday people. I have a few rich clients, but most of them are mom and pops. And I think I might be able to add something to this task force. So thank you.
Thank you, Bert. We're very pleased and honored to have you here.
I might also add, I am a member of the Oregon Association of Insurance and Financial Advisors. But I am not speaking for them. I'm here on my own behalf, not that my views might coincide with some of theirs. And I've been active politically. A year ago this time I was back in Washington, D.C. lobbying to keep the insurance laws strong for the everyday person. So, thank you.
Great. Thank you, sir. And also today, Harley Spring could not be with us, so we asked Miriam Lohman to sit in for him at this meeting. And if I'm correct, you're a legal counsel at the Standard.
I am.
Is that
I'm
correct?
An assistant counsel for Standard Retirement Services. So I specialize in the laws and regulations regarding all types of qualified plans.
Very good. So. Excellent. We're appreciative that since Harley couldn't be here, we're appreciative that you're willing to sit in and help us out today. And Anne, good afternoon. I didn't get a chance to say hello.
Hi.
So without further ado, we'll jump into the agenda. We're going to start with the best practices for increasing retirement savings by private sector workers. And we're very, very fortunate today to have the Senior Strategic Policy Advisor from the AARP Public Policy Institute and the Deputy Director of the Retirement Security Project at the Brookings Institute, David John. With us here today, and we're very pleased that you're willing to share some information with us. So if you don't mind coming up to the rostrum, since all of this is recorded, if you could just say your name again for the record,
sure.
I'd be most appreciative.
Certainly. Let's see if I can put this so it...
Yeah, and you don't have to talk right into the microphone.
Oh, good.
Very sensitive microphone. So if you're 6 or 8 inches, is that about right? Jessica's given me the thumbs
well,
up.
Well, my wife informs me that when I have something that's really important to say that I kind of tail off. So if I do that, please let me know.
Will do.
She finds that to be a negative for some reason. So, I'm David John. As you said, I'm with the AARP Public Policy Institute and the Retirement Security Project at the Brookings Institution. And I greatly appreciate the opportunity to see your usual fine weather, which I understand it's always this way. And
consistently.
Excellent. There we are. My wife is distressed that she couldn't come along as that, but one of these days. We have a problem, and I'm not going to use any particular language to describe it. And what I'm going to do is quickly summarize what I sent you. I figure that there's no need for me to read it or to throw tons of numbers or things along that line. If you'd like, it, obviously you have it before you. It's very useful. My papers are famous for inducing cures for insomnia, curing quiet crying children, and a wide variety of other things. So I'm just going to summarize so that with this. We have a problem, and it's a problem that is a current problem, but it's also a future problem. It's not just the case of the retiring baby boomers. It's a case also of the younger workers and what they're facing. Social Security is a key factor in our retirement system, and it will continue to be so. But the average Social Security new award is about $1,300 a month. So that's the average. There are some higher, some lower, et cetera. But that gives you a retirement income of about $15,600 a year, which is not nearly enough. People need to supplement what they've got coming from Social Security with additional savings. Now, any amount of savings is good, is better than having no savings at all. But we need to understand also that the amount of savings, a seemingly large amount of money, may not generate as much retirement income as we might think. So, for instance, if you look at an average individual who has $100,000 a year, and there aren't that many, sadly, who have They have $100,000 in retirement income. That generates, if you chose to turn it into a guaranteed lifetime income product, about $600 a month. It's actually about $575 for a man and about $550 or so for a woman. Women are different because of the longer longevity, of course. If you add that to the Social Security payment, you're talking about somewhere in the neighborhood of $22,000-$23,000 a year. Now, the problem is we have very few people who actually have $100,000. The gold standard for retirement statistics is something called the Employee Benefits Research Institute, EBRI. They are nonpartisan. They are funded by a wide variety of financial institutions, employers, different other groups. AARP is on their board, among other things. And EBRI found that basically 51% of workers aged 45 to 54 had less than $25,000. So they don't even come to that. We understand that one in six Oregonians has less than $5,000 saved for retirement. If you go on to the next level, 55.
Can I ask you some questions about statistics?
Yes, you may.
I've seen them, and I just want to make sure I understand what they mean.
Yes.
So 51% of those between 45 and 54 have less than $25,000. That is in a supplemental savings account of some sort, other than Social Security.
Yes.
Okay, and then the one out of six less than $5,000, is that at the time of retirement? What time period? When is that snapshot taken?
As I understand, that is individuals also within a certain period of before retirement.
Okay.
So,
it would be some range of age.
Yes.
And is the average?
The 6,000, as I understand it, is the average.
Okay.
Now, we run into some interesting problems with statistics, because very often people will look at average rather than median. Frankly, some of the studies that are around, this one, for instance, looks at average numbers. And if you think of an average, if there are two of us together, and you've got $1 million and I've got zero, the average is that 500,000. So we look pretty good. On the other hand, if you look at the median, that simply means that's the number where there are half have more than that and half of the individuals have less than that. The median is far more important as a number. We see, as I say, significant numbers of individuals who don't have sufficient savings. Now, there's an additional number that I came up with from the 2014 EBRI survey. They do this retirement confidence survey annually, and it's very highly regarded and used by industry and a wide variety of others. For the first time, they asked people, what's the difference? Do you have an employer-sponsored retirement plan or not? If you did not have the employer-sponsored retirement plan, that number, 51% number, goes up to 93. We have a study from Boston College, the Center for Retirement Research, which did some correlation studies on why lower-income individuals have less pension or retirement savings assets than others. And what they found was it is directly connected to the presence of an employer-sponsored retirement savings plan. They found that at all income levels, they had virtually the same participation rate, virtually the same take-up rate, et cetera, but a vastly different level of ability to save for retirement. And that's really where I'm getting to at this point. Access is absolutely crucial. We find.
Could I interrupt you?
Please,
I apologize.
Please interrupt. Actually, I'm happy to do this as a conversation.
Okay, great. And I'm sorry, because I want to keep this informal. So if you have questions,
much happier
please
that
just
way.
Shoot away, and then we don't have to remember them. Missing from that data set would be those who work in a private sector firm who do not have a employer-sponsored plan, but maybe have their own savings plan. Is that figured into this somehow?
Yes, I'm glad you asked that, actually. I have to admit, I don't usually use these things. Let me just see here. Let me just point to this one. Here we have a note that participation rate remains stagnant. Basically, we've had the same proportion of individuals who have access to a plan and save in the plan for decades now. We'll get to that. This is the key. This comes several different ways. Yes, an individual can, in theory, save in an IRA, regardless of whether they have an employer-sponsored plan or not. This happens to be a good graphic one. We at the Retirement Security Project developed virtually the same number. Approximately 1 in 20 individuals who have only that option actually do save for retirement on a regular basis. And the reason is very clear, because they have to make an actual active decision every month. We find that things like a car repair or the kids' dentist bills or a coming vacation gets in the way, and people don't do their savings. Where they do save is if they have access to payroll deduction, because in that case they pay themselves first. Shlomo Bernardzi, I believe, coined that term. So essentially the money goes in every month in advance of actually doing the regular spending here. Now, we found that at every single income level, individuals have said that this is crucial. Let's see, in the 2011 EBRI survey, which is the last time this question was asked. We've asked them to ask it again next year, that a total of 89.3%, in other words, 9 out of 10 individuals said that it was either very important or somewhat important to their decision to save. If you don't have access to payroll deduction, for the most part, you don't see saving.
Okay, could I hone in on this just a little, because I'm
Please.
Still not quite following. So you are saying 1 out of 20 who are employed by a private sector firm that do not have access to a savings mechanism at the firm will then be engaged in some sort of a private savings account.
Yes.
Does that include IRAs?
That is, for the most part, IRAs.
Is a 401k and an IRA, are those colloquially the same for the purposes
no,
actually, of this data?
No, that's actually what that number shows. A 401k is an employer-sponsored plan. In other words, the employer sponsors it. The employer arranges for payroll deductions to be made to that. The IRA that we're talking about here, which is a key thing because we'll talk about a different type of IRA in a moment, is the one where you, in theory, go down to the bank or to a financial services firm or something along that line, and you open
and
you make regular contributions.
Okay, I got it. I didn't see the fine print below the bar there, and I apologize. I'm wasting your time. I understand it now. Thank you. It says not covered by an employer plan deductible, IRA only.
Yeah.
Okay,
but I have a question. On your first chart, it references full-time. The line chart that covers 1987 to 2005, it says full-time, full-year wage and salary workers. What's the definition for full-time? Is it 40 hours a week? Or
it's typically
else?
40 hours in that neighborhood. It's, yes.
And does that breakdown influence the bar graph that we were just talking about that says... If the effectiveness of 401k plans, does that have any bearing on level of employment, full-time, less than full-time?
Yes, it does. However, the choice of who to cover is left to the employer. Certain employers will only cover full-time. Others will cover anyone who has, say, more than 1,000 hours in any 1 year. So that's one of the... in-betweens there. One of the things that we run into is that, for instance, if you look at that 5%, although we cannot prove it as such, I could pretty much guarantee that that 5% is the 5% at the very top of the income scale and not the 5% at the bottom of the income scale. Because these are the people who have the disposable income and also have the financial expertise. One of the problems that we see with availability is that while it's very easy for those of us who have a certain income and educational level to talk about, well, you need to go and open an account at so-and-so and do your research at on the following websites, etc., the reality is that many people live in a neighborhood where it may well be that the major financial institution is a check cashing firm or something along that line. And even at higher income levels, we find significant numbers of individuals who feel that, well, I'm not really the kind of person that's intended to go into this nice lobby, or I'm worried that these people are going to talk about very technical language and they're going to cheat me. One of the things that we discover in behavioral economics is that when people are convinced that there is an important decision to make and they don't necessarily exactly know what to do, they do nothing. They say, well, I'm going to think about this for a period of time. And that's especially dangerous in retirement savings, because if you start to save in your 20s, you can save a significant amount less per month and come out at the end with a good, comfortable retirement than if you start in your 30s or 40s. And on average, people really start to think about retirement sometime in their mid-40s or so, because at that point, they've already dealt with the house and the kids are probably started off pretty well. And then they start to think of, oh, I might live that long after all. I might actually need to deal with this issue. And of course, by that time, they need to save much more than if they had saved earlier.
I have a question.
Please.
What about self-employed? Are they also included in that 5%, or is that a separate calculation, tabulation?
For the most part, that's a separate calculation.
Yeah.
And this is actually a very serious question that we are just starting to grapple with. We know that payroll deduction works for someone who has a connection with a traditional employer. If you don't have connections with that, and one of the values that we can create, and this is true with the traditional 401k and all the various and sundry other types of retirement savings investment plans and the like, is that you can do it through payroll deduction. But what do you do if you don't have a payroll? And what we find is that the number of people who are self-employed or are business owners or the like typically have much less retirement resources than they need. So this is an area that we need to develop. It's one of the things that I'm planning on doing research in the coming year that I think needs to be given much more attention than it is. Let me go back to one of the slides here, this one. And this is a quick answer. Why are we here, essentially? Why are you here? And I must say, I'm incredibly impressed with Oregon. We're trying to get my state of West Virginia and a variety of other states to do the same type of a discussion, because you're going to be the ones, if nothing is done, who are going to end up carrying some of the weight of this. Because if you have individuals who are retiring on $22,000 a year, $25,000 a year, you make, this is not a comfortable situation. This is going to put pressure federally on things like Social Security and other benefits, but it's especially going to put pressure on the state and local governments, because you're going to be the ones who are going to be asked to help with health care provision, with housing provision, with all sorts of other services that need to be dealt with an aging population. And essentially, you've got a choice. We all do have a choice here, where we can either do nothing and allow this to be borne by the taxpayers in the future, or we can help people to start to save on their own now and to help them to basically self-finance some of these needs. And this isn't going to be just a case of people who are 50 or 50 plus or so. I have an older daughter who's 27. She's a nurse practitioner in Pittsburgh. After she took her first job, she said, well, you know, Dad, all those boring presentations that you made that I sat through, I now understand why you were doing this. So she's saving for retirement. But everyone has to have that opportunity. And if we don't have that opportunity, and as you can see here, roughly half don't. And typically, that's a problem. I mean, even if you look at that upper red line, that's 60% participation among full-time workers. 60%. That means 40%, roughly, are not participating. And this isn't just the new savers. This is the middle career people. In West Virginia, we are a small business state, as you are. And we have a lot of people who leave to go to work for a big company, and they have a 401k, and then about mid-career in their 20s or 30s or so, they decide to come home and they go to work for a smaller business, and they don't have a retirement savings plan, and they've got a gap. And this is a gap precisely when they need most to be saving. I mean, yes, it's good that they had some beforehand, but not having it beyond that is rather crucial.
Could I ask you a question about trend?
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure out what's going on there, you know, 99-2000. Is it the tech bubble that somehow caused people to retrench? Why is the trend actually down? What's going on?
The trend, yes, that's actually the dot-com bubble. This particular chart, I don't do graphics very well. As a matter of fact, I am utterly terrible at them. Hence, I borrow charts from other people with permission. This particular one stops at about 2005. If you went out to about 2008, you'd see another serious drop. So, for instance, if you look at the GAO report that you were sent earlier, what it shows is that there has been a creation of plans, but that the death of plans, the plans have been closed, actually outnumber any growth in there. So, yes, you would see that. And typically, this is a combination of things. Companies that go out of business, people who are laid off, people who are just under stress. I knew a number of people in 2008, 2009 who didn't open their 401k statements for 2 or 3 years or so, and several of them stopped saving just in case the worst happened, and they put that money in a bank account instead.
I have a couple additional questions. One is, do you know what the, not sure how to describe it, the turnover is? Are there numbers that express how many people lose coverage, or lose access because of that kind of turnover?
You know, it's not very good numbers. Typically, what we do is that we get this from survey research, and there are a variety of different survey data sources. As one of the papers that I mentioned in the this was one of the Boston College papers, said if you look at the different number sources, they all have roughly the same number when you take away a couple of biases that are in there. But we don't have a firm number of X people had it this year and Y people lost it because of this reason.
Okay. And an additional question. If everything were perfect and started today,
yes,
and everybody was covered for some future retirement, how do you have any handle on how many years it would take for that crossover from those who are behind the curve today until we get to an ideal situation where everybody has something?
It varies according to income level and access to other types of things. One of the reasons that we see studies, and for instance, there was a column in the Washington Post that I know you were sent last month talking about the fact that people are actually doing really well at the moment when they look at the baby boomers. One of the reasons for that is that if you look at the baby boomers, and particularly the early baby boomers, they are the ones who are most likely to have access to a defined benefit traditional pension plan. The younger workers are the ones who don't have that access. So if we were starting from scratch, it takes roughly 25 years to develop a really significant amount of retirement savings. And that's continuous savings in a reasonable investment choice. So we would have a while before that would happen. What we have at the moment is a better situation than that we could have, but as they say in the ads for financial services firms, you know, past performance is not a guarantee of future returns. So this is not just a case of trying to fix things now. It's a case of avoiding problems later and helping our kids and our grandkids to do much better going forward. Now, I would argue, and I'm going to be very direct about this, that education helps, but education is not enough. If you look at the access charts, if you look at the Boston College study, the one that I referenced here, it's why don't lower income individuals have pensions, etc., you see that the combination of payroll deduction and access to an employer-sponsored plan is what makes the difference. Unfortunately, much of the financial literacy training is done at a level that doesn't make a whole lot of sense to average people. And it won't make as much sense until they actually have some assets where they can look at this and understand what this actually means. I've tried this out on members of my family. My sisters are heartily sick of me asking questions about this at the moment. But things like stocks, bonds, mutual funds, and things along that line. And it's very much a case where until they actually had some savings and some activities, it was like the famous cartoon of the man talking to the dog, going, blah, 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 Rusty, blah, 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 which is what the dog heard. And my sisters have actually referred to this, and they just call me the dog occasionally in there. So access is crucial. Now, what could you do in theory? I mean, one of the things that we've seen time and time again is people talk about ERISA. Now, ERISA is an incredibly valuable and complex law. ERISA was passed in 1974. It governs retirement savings plans, et cetera. And very often when we talk to states or to even national people, they say, well, you can't do so-and-so because of ERISA. What you could do is a different kind of an IRA, a payroll deduction IRA. A payroll deduction IRA, well, here's that, and we'll get to that in a moment. Let me just get that to there. A payroll deduction IRA is an IRA, except that it, as it sounds, it's funded monthly. Now, it does not include the same types of ERISA restrictions. The IRS says very directly that in the event that, you know, payroll deduction IRAs, it's one of their publications, it's referenced in the thing, the IRS says very directly that if an employer makes it available and does not express an opinion and provides information, etc., that a payroll deduction IRA is quite acceptable. The responsibility of the employer at that point is virtually the same thing they already do for your income taxes, unemployment taxes, and a variety of Social Security taxes, etc., which is to make a deduction from the paycheck and to send it on to a central area or to an employer or a financial services firm. A payroll deduction IRA could be sponsored by a state entity. It could be sponsored by a variety of other entities also. It could be done on a public-private partnership with the responsibility for making appropriate investments already handled through a negotiation with the state. And frankly, it can be done very easily given the fact that the federal ERISA law has something wonderfully known as the QDIA, which is a qualified default investment alternative, which is basically for 401k plans, it says this is an appropriate investment. It's a target date fund for the most part. So it would be fairly simple to set something like this up and to arrange, again, public-private partnership or any other way that the state chose to handle it, and to provide information and to include an educational campaign there. It could be done through the state. It could be done in conjunction with various financial services providers and the like to get people started. Now, this would be a good idea for two major reasons. It would be a good idea for, frankly, the state and for the citizens of the state, because it would enable them to save for retirement easily, and to fill the gaps in retirement. And, of course, it would be good for the state because it would help it to avoid potential costs going forward for people who don't have enough. It's also good for financial services firms, if you think of it, because there is no reason why such a product couldn't also be distributed using financial services providers. You could do it in any number of different ways, compensated or not compensated. And I've dealt with financial services providers for years. When I talk to them about this, and we talk about retirement savings plans in particular, they always tell me the hardest sell is the first one. Because getting in the door and explaining to them how this works, especially when you have a small business person whose real concern is keeping the doors open more than anything else. But if this was structured in a way so that once they have a payroll deduction IRA and they've offered this and it's handled simply and easily, and let's face it, it's a pretty stripped down product there, they could go in afterwards and say, look, your biggest fears about payroll deduction and how to do this have been answered. Let's talk about an IRA simple. Let's talk about a simplified 401k plan or an automatic 401k plan. The reaction, then they tell me, is that this would be an easy step up. And, of course, that would provide additional benefits and additional security. When I talk to employers, and there are a variety of surveys and the like around, employers who have retirement savings benefits or other benefits say that it helps them to attract and keep good people, that they don't lose them to other competitors and things along that line. When we developed the automatic IRA, which is a national tool that a colleague of mine who's now in the Treasury Department, he became respectable, and I developed a few years ago, we had a prominent insurance company do some marketing research for us. And the people who were eligible for the auto IRA, who's virtually the same group of people who would be eligible for a payroll deduction IRA, because that's really what an auto IRA is, told us that if every single employer offered this as a benefit, they would still feel more loyalty to their employer, and they would feel better about their job.
What's the difference between a payroll deduction IRA and an auto IRA? What's the difference?
The one key difference is the automatic enrollment. And automatic enrollment is a case where...
So it's opt-out.
It's opt-out.
Okay.
And let me just quickly, this is a little aside, but... we're part of a group called Retirement Made Simpler, which is a coalition of AARP, the Retirement Security Project at Brookings, and FINRA, the private sector regulator. And we did some surveys of employees here, asking them whether they liked auto IRA. And you'll see that it made savings easier, they started saving earlier, they were satisfied with the process, glad my company offers, and this included the people who opted out. Now, that's the next step, however, because you can't do that necessarily immediately without running into ERISA complications. Please.
Is the date on that poll is 2007?
Yes.
Was there any data taken during or subsequent to whenever that might have been, the crash?
To be perfectly blunt, we ran out of funding to do that poll at the time of the crash. However, Prudential did a similar poll, except that in this one was only people who had been auto-enrolled, and the Prudential poll actually found similar levels when you correct for the fact that they were asking people who didn't have any experience with the process.
And do you know what the average size or the median size or range was of the employer, number of employees, full-time, part-time, any of that available as well?
Number is actually available on the RMS website, retirementmadesimpler.org. That's where the thing is. As I understand it, just from looking at the time, this was shortly after the Pension Protection Act of 2006 was passed, which eliminated the last legal barriers to automatic enrollment. And I would anticipate that there's probably a larger incidence of larger employers rather than smaller employers. Now, the fact is that the current standard, this current situation for small businesses isn't working. The General Accountability Office says that about 1 out of 7, that's about 14%, of small employers, which they define as 100 employees or less, actually offers some sort of a retirement savings or pension plan. Yes, there are a wide number of different types of options out there, but as you'll see in my testimony, most of those require an employer contribution of some level, or they are much more expensive. GAO says that they found for 401k plans offered to small employers, they were somewhere in the neighborhood, usually of about twice as expensive. And that's simply because you're spreading the cost over a smaller number of employees. It's not a conspiracy or anything along that line. It's cost recovery. It's a for-profit business there. In the private sector, if you do something very well, you get a bonus. And if you don't do something very well, then if you're lucky, you get reeducated. What is out there right now is not working. It needs an additional level of support or innovation.
So how do we make it simple?
easy, stripped-down features. An IRA, there are certain laws and regulations as to who can offer an IRA. That's actually a broad set of groups. Any national bank can offer it, credit unions, financial firms, et cetera. There's actually a list in the Treasury Department of who can offer that. If you include payroll deduction, if you include a very simple amount of investments, you really don't need more than, say, two or three at the most. If somebody is sophisticated enough that they want a type of investment that you don't offer in this plan, frankly, they're sophisticated enough to go to their national bank or their some other firm and open one on their own.
But small businesses aren't doing it now.
No, they're not.
So what's going to inspire them to do what you're describing?
It's going to be a combination of things. One is that if it's easy to deal with, and if you'd send money to a central provider, perhaps at the same time that you do the payments for state taxes, that you just fit it right onto that and attach it that way. You could, if you so decided, put in some sort of a requirement level. That may be an additional step for another time.
What do you mean requirement level?
Well, if you look at some of the states that are discussing this, and if you look at the National Auto IRA, it basically says that any employer above a certain size in the Auto IRA legislation, it's 10, that does not offer any other type of retirement savings or pension must offer the Auto IRA. You could also do it through incentives, however. You could incent small businesses to offer this. There are a wide variety of ways that could be used to develop and push this product. It might be advisable to start small and then build up from there.
How could you incentivize small businesses to do this?
Well, the industry tells us that what is necessary is some sort of a tax credit. In federal law, there actually is a tax credit for new plans for employers of under 100 employees. You could put some sort of a credit to state taxes in there. Obviously, that has a cost, but again, you're avoiding a cost going forward. You could do it through any other number of other ways.
Anne had a question.
Yeah.
Well, this is really interesting to me. So what I want to make sure I understand what you're describing. So it sounds like through an incentive, so a voluntary participation potentially,
mm-hmm.
The state could incentivize private companies of a certain, perhaps of a certain size or higher, or anyone who wanted to participate in offering these payroll deduction IRAs. But how would it work from a sort of mechanic standpoint when a new employee is hired, for example? Because I work at a company that's very thinly staffed from an HR
right.
perspective.
Absolutely.
And a finance perspective. So a new employee is hired, and together with their various forms they fill out, they potentially are given a form that says, here, do you want to enroll in this?
Right.
We offer it. And then if they say yes, then the payroll department
auto-deducts. Basically, it's another deduction.
And you were saying something about with the tax payments, so is that it to a centralized location? I mean, could it be structured so that private companies have bid to,
sure.
to manage this money, but could you just spin it out a little bit more?
Well, there are a lot of different ways that Oregon could structure it. So I'm just going to describe one.
Sure.
And keeping in mind that it's not a perfect way, it's just the one that might work out. If an employer uses a payroll processor, and most of those who have 10 employees or more either use a payroll processor or they use payroll software. Quicken has the same capacity. They actually already have the capacity in their dedicated cell so that you could basically put in yet another deduction there. The money would be collected from the paycheck at the time, obviously, that the paycheck is issued, weekly, biweekly, monthly, etc. It would be collected in an account in much the same way that the tax withholdings are collected, and then transmitted perhaps to, God forbid, the treasurer's office or something like that, just to drop a name here, on a regularly scheduled basis. The Treasurer's Office could, in theory, contract with private providers to offer these types of services and then forward the money on a regular basis to these private providers to actually handle the investments and issue the statements and things along that mm-hmm. line. So you're not talking about a major problem for the employer. You're not talking about really a major problem for anyone here, because it essentially is using the same type of activity that is done now, mm-hmm. but just adding an additional purpose to that.
Just to respond to that and then go to my friend here. I like the idea that we're potentially saving costs that we would incur otherwise as government by helping people do some planning. It seems like for people for whom sort of fiscal care is a really high value, mm-hmm. there's an argument to be made that this promotes very careful use of public resources by helping people not need them mm-hmm. as much. So I think it's an interesting idea. I like the idea of incentivizing rather than mandating, as employers are trying to move through a very difficult recession and climb out of it and are already feeling like they've got a lot on their plates. So thanks.
I need a little more help to understand this.
Sure.
I think this started by suggesting it could be one incentive could be a tax credit.
Sure.
And I understand about the software when I was an executive director for an organization with 8 or 10 employees. It was easy enough to set up. And we had a SEP IRA. The difference under ERISA is that the employer was right. providing the funds.
Sure.
It was still very simple. But if we take the model that you're walking us through, and a small employer has the software or is using a payroll service, and it's just simply this person wants to participate at 3%, mm-hmm. the money comes right off their paycheck, and then the payroll deductions, they go on to Otter, I think is the electronic mm-hmm. tax payment system for employers.
Yeah.
And there would be an additional field mm-hmm. there that says how much for the pension program, whatever it's called,
right.
and they punch in $12 or 1% or whatever the number is. Where would it, and that's the extent of the work on the part of the employer, how does a tax credit apply? Because in my mind, having processed these kinds of things, that's a little bit of extra work, but not a lot.
It's not an awful lot at all. And again, it could be done in a variety of ways. You could, in theory, say to an employer, if you are willing to offer this payroll deduction IRA, we will give you a tax credit of X dollars a year or something like that, or maybe X dollars for the first 2 years or something. The federal credit for opening a new plan is $500 or up to actual costs for the first 3 years that you actually do it.
That was for employees of 100 or did you say?
100 or less, 100 yes. Or less. It's one for opening a new 401k, or it would also apply to a wide variety of other types of retirement savings accounts.
But there would be no credit for a tax-exempt organization.
That depends on how you chose to structure it. I mean, hypothetically, you could offer a payment or a de minimis payment, but I would think that a tax-exempt organization might or might not need such an incentive. Again, that's one of the decisions you would have to make.
Yeah, the current 100 employees or less and $500 credit doesn't apply to
that's correct
exempt organizations.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
How about from the employee's perspective? This is after tax dollars, right?
Mm-hmm.
So is there any way you could incentivize employees?
There actually is. There are a variety of ways that you could incentivize employees. Frankly, the most effective way probably is a federal proposal, which takes a saver's credit that is already out there. The saver's credit is a fine vehicle the way it's structured right now, but unfortunately you don't benefit from it unless you've got an actual tax liability that's at least at the level of the credit. It's essentially a match or a partial match to savings. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been proposed to improve it would be to make it a refundable credit that goes directly into the account. Because in that case, what you're doing is building up resources, and of course what that does also is to reduce the burden of administrative costs. I mean, there are a lot of ways that it could be done. One of the things that we find in research among employees when we were building the auto IRA and since is that employees know they need to save, and they want to save. It's just that they don't necessarily know what to do. And this is one of the reasons why auto enrollment, for instance, is so wildly popular. It's because they feel like they're getting some guidance. Well, the employer or financial services firms or whatever have looked at this, and they think that I need to save this amount, and I need to save it in this. And that's good enough for me. That's better than me doing nothing.
Can an employer match on an IRA under
no.
this particular scheme?
No.
They are precluded by ERISA from doing that?
It's actually federal tax law makes an IRA personal savings so that the
okay.
money
and
has thus, to come
thus
from the
tax. After-tax structure.
Pay pardon?
The after-tax structure.
That actually applies in both cases.
Okay, so there's no way for... how often can somebody who... If you set this up again from the perspective of the employee, you said make it simple, 2-3 options.
Mm-hmm.
How often can you change those options? Are there any
stipulations? That's up to you, actually. I mean, that would be depending on how you structure it. One of the things that we found in our research was that there is occasionally a problem with employees in 401k plans, small 401k plans, who want to change their contributions and the like every other paycheck or something along that line. And the way that would deal with that would be if you had an open season once a year or something like that. So
at the state level, we have obviously a defined benefit plan for the
sure.
most part.
Yeah.
And we really have one option. And it's a pooled fund, it's professionally managed, and it's a diversified risk-managed global portfolio. Could some strategy like that work for this? In other words, are you taking all the incentives out if you just have one option?
No, I don't think you are, because most of people want a safe option. In other words, they're not necessarily going to be day trading or anything along that line or speculating. Most people, and we find this in automatic enrollment, that it's only up after people reach a certain level of account balance and a certain age, roughly mid-40s, et cetera, that people start to think about moving their money to a different investment. And as a matter of fact, there is research showing that in automatic plans, moderate to lower income individuals are much more likely to stick with the automatic choice, even if it's not necessarily in their benefit. So obviously you wouldn't do anything that wasn't in their benefit, but essentially the population that you're really targeting in would be much more likely to stay in that. So the fact that they have one investment choice as opposed to X actually is not a disincentive.
Okay, thank you.
I have a couple of questions. One is, are you familiar with the Secure Choice
Yes.
proposal in California?
Yeah.
So I'm having trouble seeing small business people with what we've laid out so far just all taking time off this week and going to a financial institution and saying, I put everything else on hold at the business and I'm going to do this.
Yeah, so do I.
Yeah. And so what's your opinion of things like that Secure Choice option?
Well, the secure choice option also would be done through the state.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, the state of California, once it was structured, and they have not decided how to structure it, they have a similar commission that's working on this area. But the state of California would essentially say to the employer, in their case, it's a requirement. They do have that required offering. They would say essentially, unless you've got something else, and obviously if you've got something else, a retirement savings plan, a traditional plan, or something like this, this wouldn't apply to those employers. Unless you've got something else, here it is.
This is what we're going to do.
This is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
Now, another way that you could conceivably handle some of this would be to give individual workers the ability to request their employers to allow them to sign up with this. But one way or the other, what you're talking about is a vastly simplified, easy option for the employer, where the employer doesn't have to put everything on hold. The employer doesn't have to figure out investments or go to a bank or another financial services firm and try to work out these details, because it's already been done.
My other question is, what about people who are contract workers who are self-employed, who are working at a company that's under the typical minimums that that are included in things like the secure choice? Do you see a way of making what we're talking about here also available to those folks?
Yes, you could do it. Actually, the alternative to payroll deduction is direct debit. So, for instance, my wife pays our mortgage through direct debit, and we don't see the money from one month to the next. So that's another alternative to do it. Now, one of the things that we need to discuss, and this is more of a federal question, is to make sure that the IRS rules on what is and is does not constitute an employee for purposes of taxes, that access to a retirement savings plan is not one of the things that triggers that requirement. That's one of the things that we're going to have to work on going forward. It may well be, this is one area that I have not researched, but I'm going to talk to a friend about it tomorrow night, that is already possible. It may well be that that's something that where the regulations need to be adjusted slightly.
Okay. As a follow-up, can we stretch this out a little bit with if there's an agency that has temporary work, that hires out temporary workers, could that, since you mentioned contract workers, could that agency have this kind of plan? We talked about it, and then I don't want to say take, but cause a share of that, or could those temporary workers sign up to that with that plan through that temporary agency?
You know, as long as it was, I have not researched this, so this is not, this is just off the top of my head. I will research it, and we'll see if we can get you an answer, a more direct answer. But it would seem to me that if it was the individual employee's choice to do so, that could be, that would be possible. But again, I need to research that some more.
Okay. What about mobility?
One of the things, because the account is in a central location and because the account is owned by the individual, and of course the individual is the only one who has any liability for the account, it's up to them to determine that they meet the requirements for contribution amounts and various and sundry other things. That's not up to the employer. It would, in theory, would be very easy for the individual to go from employer X to employer Y and simply say, at the same time that they're being signed up for, by the way, I have this account. I would like you to contribute or to forward my contributions to that. If the new employer has some sort of an additional account, it may well be that to the extent allowed by law, the IRA might be rolled over. A Roth IRA has, there are currently restrictions on rollovers, but it may well be that Congress chooses to change that in the foreseeable future.
Thank you.
Arian had a question.
Yeah, I have a question.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah.
If we could back up a second to talk about ERISA just a little bit.
Sure.
As well as protecting participants with respect to investment,
right.
Investment options and that kind of thing, it also protects participants from, a number of other things, like, for example, an employer who might make, a plan available to a certain group of people and not others,
right.
Might withhold, some of their deferrals, not send it in. If these aren't subject to ERISA, who would kind of police that?
Well, it could be structured in a way so that, for instance, the state could say, if you're going to offer it to one, it must be offered to all, and that's a condition of participation. So, that's one way to handle part of that. The collecting and not sending in the federal level, that's treated very similarly to what happens if you collect federal income taxes and you don't forward it to the IRS. There's actually a regular enforcement mechanism. I assume, and I'm not an expert on Oregon law by any stretch of the imagination, but I assume that the state of Oregon has a similar requirement. And it would be fairly simple if there was an involvement by, say, the treasurer's office to extend that same protection.
Yes, sir.
You haven't mentioned the SIMPLE plan, which actually stands for Simplified Incentive Match Plan for Employees. It is simple,
yes.
But it's not really named that. It's the acronym for it, where it's optional for individuals to put in, of course.
Right.
Employers can put in as well as their employees if they take a salary out of the business.
Yes.
And very little federal regulation. Up to 100 employees. 100 employees, you have to go to a 401k.
Right.
I administer a fairly large one, up to 60 people. I found it marvelous for people to automatically cover it after if they want to sign up. And here it comes, something that's my theme perhaps is,
yes,
the employee has to have some skin in the game. If they want to collect the 3% match or the 2% match, they've got to put in money out of their own pocket.
Absolutely.
And that comes a challenge. With free money, I can say to somebody, you put in $10 this paycheck, weekly pay, mm-hmm. and the company's going to put in 10. And it's all yours. You own it. And still, 25% of the people see the $10 out of that pay as being something for food on the table. And it's free money. And I can't understand. As you say, making it mandatory, you can't really do that, perhaps. But the simple plan is, I think, for some of the questions on business organizations, 800 small businesses, has it much been done with the simple plans, because they are actually very simple to administer?
They are. They were designed as such. They were designed during the Clinton administration, and it's actually a very fine plan. Unfortunately, it's topped out at roughly 15, 16 million people who have actually used that plan, and it's never really caught on. A friend of mine was in the Clinton administration at the time and helped to develop it, and he was convinced that this was going to be the breakthrough that actually increased participation and coverage, and it just has never happened.
Sure.
And we think that one of the reasons is the required employer contribution, that employers or certain employers group this with all the things they've ever heard or worried about with a 401k, and they look at the mandatory participation, and it just has not taken off.
You think it would, because the employers themselves, the cap for this year is $12,000, and if you're over age 50, it's another $2,500.
So absolutely,
reasonable amounts can be put in. It can be changed any time during the year, normally, for the percentages you're matching. Maybe this could be revamped, maybe re-advertised.
It could be, but that would require federal. It was passed by Congress, and it would require federal legislation to actually do that.
What do you think about more education on the state level?
I think it's
financial advisors and others, let small businesses know these exist.
Let me be very clear. I think that education is wonderful. I think education is absolutely essential, and it's absolutely essential at all levels. At school level, I mean, I still find it shocking that my older daughter, who went to one of the best high schools in the country, took two photography courses, two cooking courses with really interesting results, but never had to take a financial literacy course. I think that's wrong and a mistake. But I would say that any program that is only education is doomed to fail. It's a recipe for failure because there has to be something more to it. There has to be the availability of a universal retirement savings alternative. The sad fact is that we have 6 out of 7 small businesses, despite the very active participation of financial professionals, who don't offer anything. There needs to be something to shake up that situation.
The education part, I have seen, being a former educator, and very often called into the classroom to teach the classes, role-playing, making people feel it, and those have gone by the wayside because of budget cuts.
I agree. I learned in the 8th grade because I had a teacher who, frankly, was bored with the social studies curriculum and spent 2 weeks teaching us about the stock market and investments. I was 13 then. That was 50 years ago, and I remember pretty much everything he said.
So this is a great discussion, and, David, your presentation is fantastic, but I want to honor our commitment, and you've already exceeded your commitment, which I appreciate, and I know you've got a flight to catch. Are there any other burning questions before we let David go? This has been extremely helpful and thorough, and I appreciate your answering our many, many questions. I think the number of questions and the detail of the questions speaks well for the presentation that you gave.
Thank you very much.
So we're very appreciative of it. And I assume we'll stay in touch, and we'll probably have a number of other dialogues with you about this as this unfolds.
That would be great.
So thank you very much. We appreciate it. So next up, we have Dr. Mary King. And just by way of brief introduction, Dr. King is a professor of economics at Portland State University. She teaches and conducts research on the dynamics of ethnicity and gender in the labor market and the economy. Thank you so much for being here, and also thank you for accommodating our bit of a switcheroo in terms of the agenda lineup. We appreciate your accommodation.
You're welcome. I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me. I hope not to disappoint. I'm sorry I am not by any means an expert on savings or retirement. I believe I was invited because I know most about the situation of women and people of color in the labor market. So the question that I'm addressing is really, why don't women and people of color save more for retirement? And I brought some materials and can talk from some perspective about this, the kind of work that they do. But I appreciate you having me, and I really, just let me say before we run out of time or anything that happens, is I think you're engaged in a really important project here. I really appreciate everybody's time and energy on this. I think we're going to need it, so I'm really glad you're working on it. Let me say, from what I do know about retirement and retirement programs, I would echo Mr. John in his statement that what is most successful is what is mandatory, what is automatic, and that we see on the federal level the Social Security program having been tremendously successful at shifting the elderly population from a population that had the highest poverty rates among the population to that which has among the lowest poverty rates, for two reasons: that Social Security is mandatory, automatic, universal, covers everybody, and that it is referenced to inflation. It's indexed to inflation. So it doesn't always provide a lot, but it keeps people above the poverty line by and large, and that's something that none of our other programs do, really. So I would say that. And I know personally the effect of having something automatic. I'm a faculty member. I'm on a 9-month salary, and I need to research in the summer. It's public or publisher perish, but I'm not paid. And I'll tell you, I spent 2 years thinking, I don't know why I don't take my salary every 9 months, and then I'll get the interest because I'll save it, and then I'll have more at the end of the year. And after 2 years, I let Portland State give it to me over 12 months, and it worked a lot better. So I know it on a personal level as well. Now, the answer I would give to you about why women and people of color don't save more for retirement would be two-pronged. One is that they are much less likely to work in positions that have these employer programs. So to the degree that Mr. John showed you how important it is that you have that employee program, women and people of color tend to work much more often in positions that don't have benefits, don't have those employee programs, and that's huge. And then the second big answer is they have lower incomes, and that matters for savings. And, you know, I know once we separate out groups, we tend to think, well, maybe there are cultural differences and different attitudes and behaviors, and I think it's much less the case that we're going to find any explanation there than simply the first two facts, that people don't have access to the programs and they don't earn as much money. Now, I did go and look at some of the retirement research before coming to speak, and so what I brought you was two reports by Ng Retirement Research Institute, that essentially the reason I gave them to you is they have looked specifically at this question, are attitudes and behaviors of women and people of color different? And the answer is a little, but that's not what matters. It's not important that people tend to be much more similar than different across these kind of demographic characteristics. And the point is whether or not you have access to the employer programs and what incomes you have. So I thought I would spend my time with you talking just a bit, showing you really how differently women and people of color are situated in the labor market than white men, and why it is that they have lower incomes. And most of the data I'm going to show you is national. And I wanted to tell you first, you know, people get quite concerned, oh, but it's Oregon and maybe we're different, and we're not. You know, we're very average. And the kind of thing, what sort of jobs do women hold? What kind of unemployment rates do people of color have? They're very similar across the nation. And I brought you one little bit of evidence, this Oregon State profile, which gives you some information about how we stand as a state. This comes from the Institute for Women's Policy Research in D.C. But half the reason I brought it, apart from the facts and figures, is to show you the rankings. The rankings are where we stand on these out of 50 states. So here we are. We're right in the middle. We're right in the middle on almost any kind of statistic you might reference. What's the poverty rate in Oregon? What are earnings in Oregon? We're very average. So this sort of 23, 28, 31, 24 out of 50 is half the reason I brought you this, just to help you feel comfortable with you looking at national statistics rather than state. And I did bring you a lot of statistics. I'm an economist. I labor under the delusion that numbers will really move people, and that's where the argument lies, and we're far more persuaded by the numbers than our other people, but I think they're powerful, so I would like to show you a few of them. But let me give you the overview before running you through the numbers. I tried to just summarize on this short couple page, you know, one page, the differences for women and men, people of color and whites in the labor market. And if you look at how women in the dynamics for women in the economy, we still have a gender division of labor. It's eroding, but we've still got it. And it means that women tend to work in different occupations than men do. And
those occupations tend to be paid less, even when qualifications and demands are comparable. Sort of small example, women are more likely to work in the public sector than are men, and education gets you less in the public sector than it does in the private, so that's one element of women earning less. And just as a side note, the upside for women of being in different occupations, they tend to have lower unemployment rates. Those occupations and industries that are volatile and have high unemployment are male-dominated. It's construction, primarily, that kind of thing. Heavy manufacturing. Women are disadvantaged by social preference for men. There are a lot of occupations and positions for which men are preferred. Women tend to work for lower-paying firms, lower-paying organizations. You know, I'm talking about the kind of just preference that operates on a fairly subconscious social level in hiring people who are like them, that kind of thing. And they tend to be oriented to the helping professions, and those professions are paid less, partly probably because they're associated with women. And then women provide far more unpaid labor than men do. There's certainly the social expectation, strongly felt, that women will do more child care, more elder care, more sick care, and tend to work part-time more often than men because of that, or to drop out of the labor force for some period of time entirely. And that has consequences for what you earn. Now, I would flag that as an issue for this program that we're thinking about here. It's true that women are now working for pay at much higher rates than they used to. They're very nearly half the labor force. Mothers of young children are much more in the labor force than they used to be. But women work more part-time, and they do far more than men take a year or two off, something like that, if they don't take several years in a row. To the degree that the program you're looking at is tied to earnings, it's not going to cover women as well. And that might be just beyond what you can deal with here, but it is an issue. It's one reason women's poverty rates are so much higher, is we have poverty programs or anti-poverty programs that are tied to work. And to the degree that women are less tied to work than men, they work less well for them. Now, there are ways that you can structure programs to deal with that differently. I don't know that it's applicable on a state level and for a program like this, but I will just offer it to you so that it's something you can think about. But for instance, some of the Scandinavian countries make their social security at the household level so that you both pay in, and effectively we do, by marriage, but they explicitly, you pay in at the household level and you divide whatever the two partners or however many people are paying into that program, and rather than having an individual account. And that's the kind of thing we might think about. I mean, Norway goes that step further, and if you are an unpaid housewife, they give you a pension at the level of an industrial worker. But we're not there.
There's big smiles all around.
I know. Isn't it a good idea? They've got the North Sea oil, but still, they could do something else with it. The last thing is just this point that women are less likely to have pension benefits.
And pension benefits?
Pension benefits. Less likely to work in jobs with pensions. And to have more responsibilities for children and elder care. I raised that both that they may work less.
I'm sorry, Mary, to interrupt. The microphones are really sensitive, so if you should be about 6 to 8 inches away,
okay,
or it starts
great,
freaking
good.
Out.
Good. Besides, and you're just right here.
Jessica,
anyway.
Let us know if that's happening.
Thank you.
Great,
I
thanks.
Appreciate that.
I apologize.
No, thank you for saving me. So it means not only when you look at incomes, women are often sharing them among more people. And when you think about, do you think that you have room for savings? If you are responsible for more people's groceries and shoes and that kind of thing, you may feel that you have less. The overview on people of color. would be that, of course, we have our history, which has a cumulative impact. So families have different levels of wealth by race and ethnicity, and that matters for how much savings you pass on, for whether or not you have help from a family with a down payment, for whether or not your family had the ability to help you go to college, all those kinds of things. History matters for wealth and then future income. The second big issue for people of color is the high level of ongoing residential segregation in the country. It's shocking, really. It would surprise you to look at the numbers. I didn't bring them, but we're far more segregated than we imagine we would be now, decades after the Civil Rights Act. And what it means in very concrete terms is that kids of color tend to go to worse schools with more difficult situations, and it means that they, and I'm speaking on averages here, you know, strictly averages, grow up in neighborhoods with fewer resources in terms of networks, of knowing people who are going to help you either find a job or understand about college or any of these kinds of things that help you into a situation where you'll earn more money. And they call them, the economic research is all about neighborhood effects is what they're calling it, but it's also social capital networks, this kind of thing. And then, of course, there's just the ongoing, as with women, discriminatory kinds of attitudes. And the tendency of people of color, you'll look when you see what kinds of occupations they go into, even with a college education, they tend to be very much in the helping professions and in the public sector. There's both an attitude, I think, of giving back, and it's, as with women, they're not as easily welcomed into private sector positions and have are in positions that, again, have fewer pension benefits and less access to these kinds of programs. So some of it is very structural. Do you have access to these programs? And some of it is really how much money do you earn in the first place and how many people are you spreading that money over? So the thing that I brought you to demonstrate this, because I think the numbers surprise people still at how different the experience is by sex, race, and ethnicity in the country. I brought this, pulled together these statistics here, and let me just walk it through you with you. The first, women are now about half the labor force. They've been about half the labor force for some time now. That number isn't moving very quickly, even though their participation rates are lower than men's, as you can see, which means that they spend more time out of the labor force with consequences for their savings and pensions. And if you look at total incomes for, this is not just full-time workers, but everybody, you can see that women have about two-thirds what men do. If they work year-round full-time, about 80%. But, of course, women are less likely to work year-round full-time, which is what explains the difference between all people with income and year-round full-time workers. What I also wanted to show you is pulled together in this table one is how differently education pays off for people with different demographic characteristics. Excuse me. I keep thinking I have to cozy up to that mic and I have to remember I don't. But so have a look at this table one. This is people 25 and older, working year-round full-time, so we don't have that part-time issue. And you can see how different earnings are by sex and ethnicity. So that education matters. You're always better off to get more education. But education is not going to get you what it gets somebody else. And part of that is occupation. Part of that is discrimination. Part of that is history and what people expect and go into. But you can see quite a difference. Say, if you just take 4 years of college, the far right column, that's not people who have more than 4 years of college. It's exactly 4 years of college graduate, that Latinas, on average, are earning $36,000-something, whereas white men who are not Hispanic are earning $61,000. So there's almost a difference of double, not quite, but quite a difference. And you see that sex makes a bigger difference than race and ethnicity here. just as we're going to walk through all these things, I can tell you, you know, the census has gotten quite complicated. You identify yourself now, and it's a good thing, but now that you can identify as multiracial, it's also tricky. So what I'm giving you, so as not to give you 25 categories, are people who identify only as black, not mixed race, only as Asian, only as white, not Hispanic. And the Latinas or Latinos are all races, since that's an ethnicity rather than a racial designation. And I won't give you the lecture about race and how it doesn't exist, etc. But we understand it socially, so therefore it does. So you can see that education is not everything, but this, what I'm talking about, gender division of labor, really matters. People are in different occupations, they're in different positions in the labor market. And you can see that also then in Table 2, the occupational distribution of all workers by sex and earnings. And you get some sense right away, if you go down the percentage columns, that people are, you know, there's some overlap. 16% of men are in management, 12.5% of women. Men more in professional, 17.5%, women 26%. The women's jobs with college education are teaching and nursing, and those are professions, so you can see those big numbers there. You can tell, for instance, that sometimes these categories obscure more than they explain. So if you have a look at sales, it looks like about 10-11% of both women and men are in sales, but you can tell by the earnings they're in very different kinds of jobs. It's a different thing to sell cars than to sell socks, you know, and that's the earnings difference there. Healthcare support, food prep. In most occupations, well, all occupations, you can see that men are earning more, and some of it is that sort of what kind of job do you have in this category. Some of it's what firm do you work for. Some of it's how many hours do you work. Some of these kinds of things. Oh, except in the armed forces, women are earning more. But that's 0.1%. So who knows what's going on there. For the people of color, I wanted to show you Table 3. The scourge for people of color is really unemployment, especially young men, but also young women. Those unemployment rates, if you look especially at the unemployment rates 16 to 19 and 20 to 24, as people are getting their start, are very high. Now, of course, this is 2014, so this is not the depths of the Great Recession. We're recovering here. We're not by any means back to something anybody would think is full employment. But you can see the burden of unemployment falls very differently on different people. And it falls especially on young people, which is an issue for whether or not you're going to start your retirement savings right away, of course, in your 20s and 30s, but whether you have work at all. And it's really huge for us kids of color, especially African Americans, especially young men. To the point that women have more responsibility for children, I gave you this Table 4 just to show you how many more female-headed households, single mothers, there are than single fathers. Clearly, married couples both have responsibility for kids, but there are a lot more kids being raised by women in this country than by men alone. And there are people with relatively low incomes in general, which brings it around to the poverty rates, which are on the last page. And what I wanted to show you here, poverty rates by age, race, ethnicity, and sex. You can see what I'm talking about here with the success of Social Security best in the, if you look at the poverty rates in the lower right-hand corner or the two right columns, those poverty rates are now less than for the younger people. I gave you poverty rates for 45 to 54 because for most groups of people, those are the highest earnings years. And then it starts to tail off, I'm sorry to tell you, after 55. But that's, so those are the lowest poverty rates. And then they go up again in as you get older, beyond retirement age. But they're nothing like
the poverty for young people. And that, if those are the years we're talking about people starting their savings and starting their work life, we need to really think about what our programs look like. Because it's hard to imagine people are going to be saving for retirement, particularly if it's voluntary, if you're this close to the poverty line. And some of these are very high. To the point of savings, if you've got young children in the household, I give you the highest poverty rates in Table 5. The highest poverty rates in the country are among single mother families with kids under 5. It's very hard to earn much money in this situation, as you can imagine. And the poverty rates are extreme. And we tend to think of it sometimes as a race issue, and it's really not, as you can see here. It's really an issue. Of course, race makes a difference, but it's a huge issue of how much time do you have to work, given how much responsibility you have with kids. And also, I bring to you the poverty rates of kids under 18, and because I have numbers on Oregon for that, if we go to that age group here. Poverty rates for kids are the highest. The reason I tell you that is not only to flag the poverty rates for kids, but to flag what it means for young families. Because, I mean, the kids, these are not kids on the street. These aren't poverty rates of kids alone. These are poverty rates of kids living in families. And so these are poverty rates for families with young parents and single parents. And they're very high. So this, I think, is the issue that you're dealing with when you're dealing with women, when you're dealing with people of color. Clearly, everybody's not poor. But these are the populations that are most poor, have the lowest earnings, the highest unemployment rate, and are more likely to be out of the labor force. So those are the challenges. And I think some of the strategies you've been thinking about with portability and making things automatic are some of the best strategies you've got. But I think this also shows it's not going to cover everything. We aren't going to catch everybody without thinking about something else, and certainly not without thinking, as I was listening to Mr. John present, about the kind of tax credits that incentivize participation. They can't be tax credits that only apply if you owe money. They have to be like the earned income tax credit or something like that, that apply regardless and you get it back. Because these are at the, you know, in the most vulnerable ends, people don't owe taxes. I'm told I teach very depressing stuff.
I was just thinking that. It's like having a conversation with the state treasurer.
Being audited.
Or being audited. Very good.
Oh, there you go.
Trip to the dentist. Could I ask you a question? I mean, you had obviously the opportunity to hear Mr. John speak, Dr. John, and I'm very appreciative of the presentation you just gave, because it obviously shows not only a huge gap, I think it shows an almost titanic challenge in terms of what we're trying to do. Even if you use auto-deduct, and even if you made it simple, how can you, with a straight face, and I don't mean you, I mean we, collectively, how do you approach a single female head of household with children that's in poverty and say we want to auto-deduct anything? I mean, if they're already in poverty, it seems like you're taking a percentage of something less than adequate.
It's a problem, and we've already cranked up payroll taxes quite a bit. If you look what has happened with Social Security, I think it's really debatable whether it was a good idea to raise rates so much, but now that Social Security is up to 15% in total and there are other payroll taxes, I think it's a real question. Now, Oregon has a higher minimum wage than other states, but I do think you need to be thinking about the package. Oregon is also hopefully having the advantage of the Oregon Health Plan and some of these kinds of things, because clearly a retirement program is not the be-all and end-all for dealing with all of these social issues.
Absolutely. Yes, Anne?
Thanks. What a wonderful presentation. I mean, not information that we feel great about hearing, but it's so important as we try to think through pathways forward that work for our larger community. It amazes me the extent to which the people who might be able to be touched by starting earlier and saving more are the very people who generally are not going to have pensions, for whom the existence of Social Security is much shakier, for whom public employee benefits are going to be totally different from those of people who will retire in the next 10 years or who are already retired. I think we have to pause and just think for a second about what a different package of potential compensation people who are younger have potential access to. I mean, it's really profound. I think as we address these social problems, issues, challenges, we have to think about that. It's a really different ballgame for people, you know, under age 45, under age 35, under age 25. And so, anyway, that's very distressing. But we have to do something productive. And I'm wondering what you think about employment-related daycare as part of the suite of things we need to be working on if we're trying to help people earn the money that will help them save, so that when they have no pension and they don't have Tier 1 PERS and they don't have Social Security or whatever else they don't have, they've got something. And then also earned income tax credit. You know, if you were making policy knowing what you make, how would those needs fit into the work of a body like ours or the state legislature?
Well, at the risk of alienating everybody in the room, I would say that if I were making policy, I would create Scandinavia, because they have 3% child poverty rates, you know, and there's the reason for that. But, I mean, it's not, people instantly think, oh, high taxes. But if you look at those tax rates, they're very comparable to what we pay as we pay privately. But we pay privately for education, we pay privately for child care, we pay privately for medical care, and if you add up what we pay, it's comparable to what the Scandinavians pay. But that's a side note I won't go off on any further. But let me tell you that I think you're absolutely right that employment-related daycare is huge. And if you look at the Scandinavians, who have much lower child poverty rates, a big part of what they have is both publicly available high-quality child care, which makes a huge difference for women staying in the labor force and maintaining connection. And oddly, and less intuitively, they have paid family leave. And I don't know why it is that that helps people retain their connection to the labor force, unless it is the fact that it's understood that you're going to leave work for a little while and come back. Whereas in the U.S., you just quit. You just quit, and who knows if you ever come back and with whom. Whereas that relationship in Scandinavia gets held a little bit more. Hmm. It keeps women's earnings up. And women's earnings are critical for kids. Hmm. But I think you're right. It's a package, and to the degree that you're thinking about it all, terrific.
Some critics of this, of the whole way retirement is structured in this country, and I'm asking you as an economist if you have a reaction to this, say that all this focus with 401ks, SEP IRAs, simple IRAs, various investment strategies is misplaced because it focuses on wealth building, which the argument goes is somewhat different than a retirement program, so that every one of us takes the risk to build whatever wealth we can, including the ones we've just been describing who have no capacity to build any kind of wealth from, if you look at the statistics, and that your reference, what triggered this and made me think about it again, was your reference to something that is automatic, universal, and that essentially is the Social Security system, which really describes something different than wealth accumulation. You pay in, but you get a defined benefit program, and we all know defined benefit programs started falling off the table in about the time ERISA was created, and have declined significantly over the decades and been replaced by these wealth building programs. Do you have any reaction to that or impression on it?
Well, I think you're absolutely correct in what you say, and I think in terms of, you know, Social Security is not a wealth building program. It is social insurance, fundamentally, is what it is in it. So it creates a pool where people are paying in and covering the people who are retired. And the demise of Social Security is much exaggerated for political purposes. You know, it's a much stronger program than many of us are being led to believe. It will exist longer. And I personally really question whether or not we needed to raise payroll taxes in the way that we have, rather than do something differently, like move the cap on earnings, for instance. But I don't know if there's any way to consider anything that would be more Social Security-like at the state level, because it has a tremendous number of advantages. I mean, I think the program you're considering has many of the advantages by getting away from individual retirement accounts and lots of fees and lots of administration and all that kind of thing, by going toward automatic, by going toward simple, by pooling resources, having something like the PERS kind of management. I'm in PERS, you know, what a well-managed pension organization. People understand what they're doing. And we aren't all having to figure it out. I think, yes, the way that this state program that I understand y'all to be considering has those advantages of something like Social Security, it's very positive. To the degree to which it isn't exactly Social Security, it would be better if it were. You know, we wouldn't have all these details. But it seems to me that this gets about as close as you can without being Social Security by having it be a small check that an employer makes and having it be collectively managed. But no, I think you're absolutely right. And the shift to defined contribution was a tremendous shame in terms of what people, the kind of security older people have. And I think you're also right that what it means for young people, they face so much more difficult an economic situation than we did, and certainly even our parents did. Although it's getting better. I have an 18-year-old and a 25-year-old, so I keep telling them, you know, the recession isn't permanent, but some things are.
Other questions?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for telling all the children. The only thing I would say is, you know, when you look at some of these poverty rates or the unemployment rates, they're high, but they're not the majority. So it means that whatever you do through the employment system still is going to hit most people. It will. But it means it's not the silver bullet.
Great. Dr. King, thank you. That was a very powerful presentation. We appreciate your time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Great. Let's see. We have public comment. We have one person signed up at this point, Ken Myers, and I believe you've also provided some materials for us related to health care. So if people could find that, I think that's the corpus of Mr. Myers' comments.
I do not believe there's any written materials from him.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry, I meant the PowerPoint.
Yeah,
thank you. If you could state your name again for the record, sorry to make you duplicate.
Okay. Good afternoon. I'm Ken Myers. Before retiring from a career in healthcare administration, some 45 years in various capacities, mostly running hospitals and clinics, I'm now working with AARP and in their retirement security initiative. I have been badgering them at the office about healthcare costs as part of the retirement security thing for so long. I think they're getting tired of hearing me, and they sent me down here to badger you. I really want to describe the problem, and it's closely linked to retirement savings. It won't take long. It's a beautiful day out there, and I want to get you out. It has a huge impact on people's savings and on their retirement security. This has been something that's been on my mind for a long time, because I started working in a business office in a California hospital when I was very young. And one of the first things I did, they had me do, was vividly remember, I had to go up to a room and get a guy to sign over his house for collateral before they do the surgery.
Yikes.
That was a long time ago. And there's been a lot of effort to make changes, but it hasn't been very fruitful. They have the Medicare, Medicaid, the Affordable Care Act. People have been having problems paying for health care forever, but it continues to get more expensive, and the problem becomes greater. So today, retirees are facing a bleak future because healthcare costs are increasing, employer pensions have declined, and individual savings are often inadequate. So the magnitude of this healthcare cost increase can be seen if we look at this display that's up now. You can see that between 1960 and up to 2010, the rate of increase of the gross domestic product in this country has gone up and up and up and up, from 6%, 5% up to almost 20%. And it's continuing to do that. The interesting thing, since we brought up Scandinavia, I've got Canada in here, and you can see that their rate of increase is less. And you can't avoid the question as to why, and I'm not going to get into that, but it certainly makes you wonder. When Medicare came into existence, there was great hope that the elderly would receive health care with little or no financial burden. Unfortunately, health care costs have been rising dramatically over the years, and now Medicare covers only about 50% of out-of-pocket costs. And again, you'll see that because the costs are controlled better in Canada, the out-of-pocket expenses there are significantly less, so there they get more coverage out of their Medicare than we do. We get 51%, they get almost 80%. So various studies have calculated that a couple retiring at age 65 could easily have out-of-pocket expenses of, what they do here, could easily have out-of-pocket expenses.
Are you trying to move to the next slide? There you go.
There you go. And I found this article online in the New York Times where they're saying that because Medicare only covers 51% of health care, a 65-year-old couple retiring this year could have a cost out-of-pocket of retirement of over $200,000. So if you go back to what some of them was mentioned earlier about many people have only $23,000-$25,000 in savings going into retirement, and you're going to spend over $200,000 on health care costs, you're in significant trouble. And unfortunately, The oldest and the poorest spend more than a quarter of their income on health care. Now, these are old numbers. These came from our AARP and haven't been updated lately, but just in 2007, beneficiaries 85 and older spent about 28% of their income on health care expenses, compared with beneficiaries age 65, 69, spent 11%. I'm sure those percentages have gone up. And it's a sad story. These many trends have placed a huge burden on current and future retirees. One indication of this problem is the increased number of bankruptcies in this country. Oops, there's the wrong one. There are 1.7 million Americans live in households that will declare bankruptcy because of medical bills. 15 million adults will use up all their savings to pay for medical bills. of the bankruptcies have a medical cause. And interestingly enough, most of those debtors were well-educated, middle-class, had health insurance. And the saddest of all, the share of bankruptcies attributed to medical problems rose 50% between 2021 and 2007. And I'm sure that's gone up. So clearly the problems I've discussed or described need attention, but the solutions are not easy. Creating more retirement savings programs and getting people to contribute is a major challenge and needs to be addressed quickly because there is a long lead time for people who are planning their eventual retirement. Unfortunately, increased savings will not be the only answer because the increasing cost of health care will overwhelm these savings if other significant changes are not made. Dealing with health care costs is a huge problem and often controversial, a la the Affordable Care Act. There's no easy answer, but some people have tried. Dr. Gerald Friedman, an economist at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, has concluded that upgrading the nation's Medicare program and expanding it to cover people of all ages would yield over $500 billion in efficiency savings in the first year of operation, enough to pay for high-quality comprehensive health benefits for all residents of the United States at lower costs for most individuals, families, and businesses. Looking at how other countries control their health care spending might also be useful. If U.S. does not solve the problem of health care costs, link it with the increased savings, then people in this country are in for a tough, tough time. And I really hope that this happens, what you're working on, this happens quickly, as soon as possible, because people need to start savings when they're facing this kind of a problem in healthcare. So I wish you good luck and Godspeed.
Thank you, sir. We appreciate your testimony. So that's all we had signed up. Anybody else? Hearing none, we're adjourned.